This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Daisy Jones and the Six by Taylor Jenkins Reid. Read for you by Jennifer Beals, Benjamin Bratt, Judy Greer, Pablo Schreiber, Ari Fliakos, January Lavoy, Julia Whalen, and a full cast. Author's note. This book is an attempt to piece together a clear portrait of how the renowned 1970s rock band Daisy Jones and the Six rose to fame, as well as what led to their abrupt and infamous split while on tour in Chicago on July 12, 1979. Over the course of the last 8 years, I have conducted individual interviews of current and former members of the band, as well as family, friends, and industry elite who surrounded them at the time. The following oral history is compiled and edited from those conversations, as well as relevant emails, transcripts, and lyrics. The complete lyrics to their album, Aurora, can be found at the back of the book. While I have aimed for a comprehensive approach, I must acknowledge that this proved impossible. Some potential interviewees were difficult to track down, some were more forthcoming than others, and some, unfortunately, have passed on. This book serves as the first and only time members of the band have commented on their history together. However, it should also be noted that, on matters both big and small, sometimes accounts of the same event differ. The truth often lies, unclaimed, in the middle. The Groupie Daisy Jones, 1965 to 1972. Daisy Jones was born in 1951 and grew up in the Hollywood Hills of Los Angeles, California. The daughter of Frank Jones, the well-known British painter, and Leanne Lefebvre, a French model, Daisy started to make a name for herself in the late 60s as a young teenager on the Sunset Strip.
Elaine Chang, biographer, author of Daisy Jones, Wildflower. Here is what is so captivating about Daisy Jones, even before she was Daisy Jones. You've got a rich white girl growing up in L.A. She's gorgeous, even as a child. She has these stunning big blue eyes, dark cobalt blue. One of my favorite anecdotes about her is that in the 80s, a colored contact company actually created a shade called Daisy Blue. She's got copper red hair that is thick and wavy and takes up so much space. And then her cheekbones almost seem swollen. That's how defined they are. And she's got an incredible voice that she doesn't cultivate, never takes a lesson. She's born with all the money in the world, access to whatever she wants, artists, drugs, clubs, anything and everything at her disposal. But she has no one, no siblings, no extended family in Los Angeles, two parents who are so into their own world that they are all but indifferent to her existence. Although, they never shy away from making her pose for their artist friends. That's why there are so many paintings and photos of Daisy as a child. The artists that came into that home saw Daisy Jones, saw how gorgeous she was, and wanted to capture her. It's telling that there is no Frank Jones piece of Daisy. Her father is too busy with his male nudes to pay much attention to his daughter. And in general, Daisy spends her childhood rather alone. But she's actually a very gregarious, outgoing kid. Daisy would often ask to get her hair cut just because she loved her hairdresser. She would ask neighbors if she could walk their dogs. There was even a family joke about the time Daisy tried to bake a birthday cake for the mailman. So, this is a girl that desperately wants to connect. But there's no one in her life who is truly interested in who she is, especially not her parents. And it really breaks her. But it is also how she grows up to become an icon. We love broken, beautiful people. And it doesn't get much more obviously broken and more classically beautiful than Daisy Jones. So, it makes sense that Daisy starts to find herself on the Sunset Strip, this glamorous, seedy place.
Daisy Jones, singer Daisy Jones and the Six. I could walk to the Strip from my house. I was about 14, sick of being stuck in the house, just looking for something to do. I wasn't old enough to get into any of the bars and clubs, but I went anyway. I remember bumming a cigarette off of a roadie for the Birds when I was pretty young. I learned quickly that people thought you were older if you didn't wear your bra, and sometimes I'd wear a bandana headband like the cool girls had on. I wanted to fit in with the groupies on the sidewalk with their joints and their flasks and all of that. So I bummed a cigarette from this roadie outside the Whiskey A Go-Go one night, the first time I'd ever had one, and I tried to pretend I did it all the time. I held the cough in my throat and what have you, and I was flirting with him the best I could. I'm embarrassed to think about it now, how clumsy I probably was. But eventually some guy comes up to the roadie and says, "We gotta get inside and set up the amps," and he turns to me and he says, "You coming?" And that's how I snuck into the Whiskey for the first time. I stayed out that night until 3 or 4 in the morning. I'd never done anything like that before. But suddenly, it was like I existed. I was part of something. I went from 0 to 60 that night. I was drinking and smoking anything anybody would give me. When I got home, I walked in through the front door, drunk and stoned, and crashed in my bed. I'm pretty sure my parents never even noticed I was gone. I got up, went out the next night, did the same thing. Eventually, the bouncers on the Strip recognized me and let me in wherever I was going. The Whiskey, London Fog, the Riot House. No one cared how young I was.
Greg McGinnis, former concierge, the Continental Hyatt House. Aw, man. I don't know how long Daisy was hanging around the Hyatt House before I noticed her. But I remember the first time I saw her. I was on the phone and in walks this crazy tall, crazy skinny girl with these bangs and the biggest, roundest blue eyes you ever saw in your life, man. She also had this smile, huge smile. She came in on the arm of some guy, I don't remember who. A lot of the girls around the Strip back then, I mean, they were young, but they tried to seem older. Daisy just was, though. Didn't seem like she was trying to be anything, except herself. After that, I noticed she was at the hotel a lot. She was always laughing. There was nothing jaded about her, at least when I knew her. It was like watching Bambi learn how to walk. She was real naive and real vulnerable, but you could tell. There was something about her. Well, I was nervous for her, tell you the truth. There were so many men in that scene that were into girls, into young girls. 30-something rock stars sleeping with teenagers, not saying it was okay, just saying that's how it was. How old was Lori Maddox when she was with Jimmy Page? 14, and Iggy Pop and Sable Starr? He sang about it, man. He was bragging about it. When it came to Daisy, I mean the singers, the guitarists, the roadies, everybody was looking at her. Whenever I saw her, though, I'd try to make sure she was doing all right. I kept tabs on her here and there. I really liked her. She was just cooler than anything else happening around her.
I learned about sex and love the hard way. That men will take what they want and feel no debt. That some people only want one piece of you. I do think there were girls, the plaster casters, some of the GTOs, maybe they weren't being taken advantage of, I don't know, but it was a bad scene for me at first. I lost my virginity to somebody that, it doesn't matter who it was. He was older. He was a drummer. We were in the lobby of the Riot House, and he invited me upstairs to do some lines. He said I was the girl of his dreams. I was drawn to him mainly because he was drawn to me. I wanted someone to single me out as something special. I was just so desperate to hold someone's interest. Before I knew it, we were on his bed, and he asked me if I knew what I was doing, and I said yes, even though the answer was no. But everyone always talked about free love and how sex was a good thing. If you were cool, if you were hip, you liked sex. I stared at the ceiling the whole time, waiting for him to be done. I knew I was supposed to be moving around, but I stayed perfectly still, scared to move. All you could hear in the room was the sound of our clothes rubbing up against the bedspread. I had no idea what I was doing or why I was doing the things I knew I didn't want to be doing. But I've had a lot of therapy in my life now, and I mean a lot of therapy. And I see it now. I see myself clearly now. I wanted to be around these men, these stars, because I didn't know how else to be important. And I figured I had to please them if I wanted to stay. When he was done, he got up, and I pulled my dress down, and he said, "If you want to go back down to your friends, that's all right." I didn't really have any friends, but I knew he meant I needed to leave. So I did. He never talked to me again.
Simone Jackson, disco star. I remember seeing Daisy on the dance floor one night at the Whiskey. Everybody saw her. Your eye went right to her. If the rest of the world was silver, Daisy was gold.
Simone became my best friend.
I brought Daisy out with me everywhere. I never had a sister. I remember it was a Sunset Strip riot when all of us went down to Pandora's and protested the curfew and the cops. Daisy and I went out, protested, met up with some actors and went over to Barney's Beanery to keep partying. After that, we went back to somebody's place. Daisy passed out on this guy's patio. We didn't go home until the next afternoon. She was maybe 15. I was probably 19. I just kept thinking, doesn't anybody care about this girl but me? And by the way, we were all on speed back then, even Daisy, as young as she was. But if you wanted to stay skinny and be up all night, you were taking something. Mostly Bennies or Black Beauties.
Diet pills were an easy choice. It didn't even feel like a choice. It didn't even feel like we were getting high at first. Coke, too. If it was around, you took a bump. People didn't even consider it an addiction. It wasn't like that.
My producer bought me a place in Laurel Canyon. He wanted to sleep with me. I told him no, and he bought it for me anyway. I had Daisy move in. We ended up sharing a bed for 6 months. So I can tell you firsthand, that girl never slept. I'd be trying to fall asleep at 4 in the morning, and Daisy would want the light on so she could read.
I had pretty bad insomnia for a long time, even when I was a kid. I'd be up at 11 o'clock, saying I wasn't tired, and my parents would always yell at me to just go to sleep. So in the middle of the night, I was always looking for quiet things to do. My mom had these romance novels hanging around, so I would read those. It would be 2 in the morning, and my parents would be having a party downstairs, and I'd be sitting on my bed with my lamp on, reading Dr. Zhivago or Peyton Place. And then it just became a habit. I would read anything that was around. I wasn't picky. Thrillers, detective novels, sci-fi. Around the time I moved in with Simone, I found a box of history biographies on the side of the road one day up in Beechwood Canyon. I tore through those in no time.
I'll tell you, she's the entire reason I started wearing a sleeping mask. But then I kept doing it because I look chic.
I was living with Simone for 2 weeks before I went home to get more clothes. My dad said, "Did you break the coffee maker this morning?" I said, "Dad, I don't even live here."
I told her the one condition of living with me was that she had to go to school.
High school was not easy for me. I knew that to get an A, you had to do what you were told. but I also knew that a lot of what we were being told was bullshit. I remember one time I was assigned an essay on how Columbus discovered America. And so I wrote a paper about how Columbus did not discover America because he didn't. But then I got an F. I said to my teacher, "But I'm right." And she said, "But you didn't follow the assignment."
She was so bright, and her teachers didn't seem to really recognize that.
People always say I didn't graduate high school, but I did. When I walked across the stage to get my diploma, Simone was cheering for me. She was so proud of me. And I started to feel proud of myself, too. That night, I took the diploma out of its case, and I folded it up, and I used it like a bookmark in my copy of Valley of the Dolls.
When my first album flopped, my record label dropped me. My producer kicked us out of that place. I got a job waiting tables and moved in with my cousin at Leimert Park. Daisy had to move back in with her parents.
I just packed up my stuff from Simone's and drove it right back to my parents' place. When I walked in the front door, my mom was on the phone smoking a cigarette. I said, "Hey, I'm back." She said, "We got a new couch," and then just kept on talking on the phone.
Daisy got all of her beauty from her mother. Jean was gorgeous. I remember I met her a few times back then. Big eyes, very full lips. There was a sensuality to her. People used to always tell Daisy she looked just like her mother. They did look similar, but I knew better than to tell Daisy that. I think one time I said to Daisy, "Your mom is beautiful." Daisy said to me, "Yeah, beautiful and nothing else."
When we got kicked out of Simone's house, that was the first time I realized that I couldn't just float around living off other people. I think I was 17, maybe. And it was the first time I wondered if I had a purpose.
Sometimes Daisy would be over at my place taking a shower or doing the dishes. I'd hear her sing Janis Joplin or Johnny Cash. She loved singing Mercedes-Benz. She sounded better than anybody else. Here I was trying to get another record deal, taking voice lessons all the time, really working at it. And Daisy, it was so easy for her. I wanted to hate her for it, but Daisy's not very easy to hate.
One of my favorite memories was Simone and I were driving down La Cienega together, probably in my BMW I had back then. They've got that huge shopping center there now, but back then it was still the record plant. I don't know where we were headed, probably at a Jan's to get a sandwich, but we were listening to Tapestry, and You've Got a Friend came on. Simone and I were singing so loud along with Carole King, but I was really listening to the lyrics too. I was really feeling it. That song always made me thankful for her, for Simone. There's this peace that comes with knowing you have a person in the world who would do anything for you, that you would do anything for. She was the first time I ever had that. I got a little bit teary in the car listening to that song. I turned to Simone and I opened my mouth to talk, but she just nodded and said, "Me too."
It was my mission to make Daisy do something with her voice, but Daisy wasn't going to do a single thing she didn't want to do. She'd really come into herself by then. When I met her, she was still a bit naive, but let's just say she'd gotten tougher.
I was seeing a couple guys back then, including Wyatt Stone of The Breeze, and I didn't feel the same way about him that he felt about me. This one night, we were smoking a joint up on the roof of this apartment over Santa Monica, and Wyatt said, "I love you so much, and I don't understand why you don't love me." I said, "I love you as much as I'm willing to love anybody," which was true. I wasn't really willing to be vulnerable with anybody at that point. I had felt too much vulnerability too young. I didn't want to do it anymore. So that night after Wyatt goes to bed, I can't sleep, and I see this piece of paper with a song he's writing, and it's clearly about me. It says something about a redhead and mentioned the hoop earrings that I was wearing all the time, and then he had this chorus about me, having a big heart but no love in it. I kept looking at the words thinking, this isn't right. He didn't understand me at all. So I thought about it for a little while and got out a pen and paper. I wrote some things down. When he woke up, I said, your chorus should be more like, big eyes, big soul, big heart, no control, but all she got to give is tiny love. Wyatt grabbed a pen and paper and he said, say that again. I said, it was just an example. Write your own goddamn song.
Tiny Love was Abreeza's biggest hit, and Wyatt pretended he wrote the whole thing.
Wyatt Stone, lead singer, The Breeze. Why are you asking me about this? This is water under the bridge. Who even remembers?
It was starting to be a pattern. Once I was having breakfast at Barney's Beanery with a guy, this writer, director. Now, back then I always ordered champagne with breakfast, but I was also always tired in the morning because I wasn't sleeping enough, so I needed coffee. Of course, I couldn't order just coffee because I'd be too amped from the pills I was taking, and I couldn't just have the champagne because it would put me to sleep. You understand the problem. So I used to order champagne and coffee together, and at the places where servers knew me, I used to call it an up and down. Something to keep me up, something to keep me down. And this guy thought it was hilarious. He said, I'm going to use that in something one day. And he wrote it down on a napkin and put it in his back pocket. I thought to myself, what the hell makes you think I'm not going to use it in something one day? But of course, there it was in his next movie. That's how it was back then. I was just supposed to be the inspiration for some man's great idea. Well, fuck that. That's why I started writing my own stuff.
I was the only one encouraging her to make something of herself with her talent. Everybody else just tried to make something of themselves with what she had.
I had absolutely no interest in being somebody else's muse. I am not a muse. I am the somebody. End of fucking story.
The Rise of the Six, 1966 to 1972. The Six started out as a blues rock band called the Dunn Brothers in the mid-60s out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Billy and Graham Dunn were raised by single mother Marlene Dunn after their father, William Dunn Sr., left in 1954.
Billy Dunn, lead singer, The Six. I was 7 when Dad left. Graham was 5. One of my first memories was when Dad told us he was moving to Georgia. I asked if I could come with him, and he said no. But he left behind this old silver-tone guitar, and Graham and I would fight over who got to play it. Playing that thing was about all we did. Nobody taught us, we taught ourselves. Then when I got older, sometimes I'd stay late after school, mess around on the piano in the chorus room. Eventually, when I was about 15 or so, Mom saved up and bought Graham and I an old Strat for Christmas. Graham wanted that one, so I let him have it, and I kept the silver tone.
Graham Dunn, lead guitar, The Six. Once Billy and I each had a guitar, we started to write new songs together. I wanted the silver tone, but I could tell it meant more to Billy, so I took the Strat.
Everything grew from there.
Billy really got into songwriting, really into the lyrics. All he'd talk about was Bob Dylan. Me, I was more of a Roy Orbison guy. I think we both had stars in our eyes, wanted to be the Beatles. But everybody wanted to be the Beatles. You wanted to be the Beatles, and then you wanted to be the Stones.
For me, it was Dylan and Lennon. Freewheelin' Bob Dylan and Hard Day's Night. Those men were my guides.
In 1967, with the brothers in their teens, they brought on drummer Warren Rhodes, bassist Pete Loving, and rhythm guitarist Chuck Williams.
Warren Rhodes, drummer, The Six. A drummer needs a band. It's not like being a singer or a guitarist. You can't just perform on your own. No girls were saying, "Oh, Warren, play me the drum beat from Hey Joe." And I wanted in, man. I was listening to The Who, The Kinks, The Yardbirds, stuff like that. I wanted to be Keith Moon and Ringo and Mitch Mitchell.
Warren we liked right from the start. And then Pete was an easy grab, went to school with us, played bass for this high school band that played our prom. When they broke up, I said, "Pete, come on, come join us." He was always really cool about stuff. He just wanted to rock out. Then there was Chuck. Chuck was a few years older than the rest of us, from a few towns over. But Pete knew him, vouched for him. Chuck was real clean cut. Square jaw, blonde hair, all that. But we auditioned him. Turned out he was better than me at rhythm guitar. I wanted to be a front man, and now we had a full five-man band, so I could do that.
We got a lot better really quickly. I mean, all we were doing was practicing.
Day in and day out, I woke up, grabbed my sticks, and headed over to Billy and Graham's garage. If my thumbs were bleeding when I went to bed, it was a good day.
I mean, what else were we going to do? None of us had girlfriends except Billy. All the girls wanted to date Billy, and I swear it was like Billy was in love with a new girl every week. He'd always been like that. In elementary school, he'd asked out his second grade teacher. Mom always said he was born girl crazy. She used to joke it'd be the end of him.
We played house parties and a bar here and there for maybe about 6 months or so, maybe a little longer. Got paid in beer, which, when you're underage, isn't so bad.
We weren't always hanging out in the, let's say, classiest of places. There were a few times a fight would break out over something, and you were worried you might get caught in the crossfire. This one time we were playing a gig at a dive bar, and this guy in the front got a little too jacked up on something. He starts swinging punches at people. I'm minding my own business, playing my riffs, when suddenly he's coming for me. And then it all went lightning fast. Boom. He was on the ground. Billy had taken him out. Billy had done the same thing when we were little kids. I was headed down to the Five and Dime, and some kid tried to jump me for a couple nickels. Billy ran up to us and then just flattened him.
You knew back then not to say any shit about Graham if Billy could hear you. You know, Graham wasn't that good when we were starting out. I remember one time Pete and I were saying to Billy, "Maybe we should replace Graham." And Billy said, "Say that again and Graham and I will replace you." Honestly, I thought that was cool. I was thinking, all right, I'm not going to get involved then. Never did bother me much that Billy and Graham thought of the band as theirs. I liked thinking of myself as a drummer for hire. I was just trying to have a good time playing in a good band.
We started to play enough that some people around town knew who we were. And Billy was just starting to get into his lead singer thing. He had a look, you know. We all did. We stopped cutting our hair.
I wore jeans everywhere. Got really into big belt buckles.
Graham and Pete started wearing these tight t-shirts. I'd tell them, "I can see your nipples." But they thought that was cool.
We got hired for this wedding. It was a big deal. A wedding meant we were going to be heard by, you know, 100 people. I think I was 19. We had auditioned for this couple with our best song. It was this slower, folkier song I'd written called Nevermore. Just thinking about it makes me cringe, truly. I was writing about the Catonville Nine, things like that. I thought I was Dylan, but, you know, we got the gig. About halfway through our show at this wedding, I noticed this 50-something guy dancing with this 20-something girl, and I thought, does this guy know what a creep he looks like? And then I realize it's my dad.
Our father was there with this young girl about our age. I realized it before Billy, I think. Recognized him from the pictures our mom kept in the shoebox under her bed.
I couldn't believe it. He'd been gone 10 years by that point, and he was supposed to be in Georgia. That asshole was just standing, right in the middle of the dance floor, no idea his sons were up on stage. It had been so long since he'd seen us, he didn't even recognize us. Not our faces or our voices, nothing. When we finished playing, I watched him walk off the dance floor. Didn't so much as look at us. I mean, what kind of a sociopath do you have to be to not notice your own sons when they are right there in front of you? How is that even possible? In my experience, biology kicks in. You meet that kid, you know it's yours, you love that kid. That's just how it works.
Billy asked a few people at the wedding about him. Turns out our father had been living a few towns over, friends with the bride's family or something. Billy was boiling mad, saying he didn't even recognize us. I always thought he probably did recognize us and just didn't know what to say.
It messes with you when your own father doesn't care about you enough to say hello. I'm not saying it was a self-pity thing. I wasn't sitting there asking, why doesn't he love me? It was more, oh, okay, this is how dark the world can be. Some fathers don't love their sons. It was a lesson in what not to be, I'll tell you that much.
Seemed like he was a drunk asshole anyway, so good riddance to him.
After the wedding had ended and everyone was packing up, I had a few too many beers, and I saw this woman working as a cocktail waitress at the hotel bar. Gorgeous girl. Real long brown hair down to her waist, big brown eyes. I'm a sucker for brown eyes. I remember she was wearing this tiny little blue dress. She was short, and I liked that. I was standing there in the hotel lobby on my way to the van, and she was waiting on a customer over at the bar. You could tell, just watching her, that she wasn't taking shit from anybody.
Camila Dunn, wife of Billy Dunn. Oh, my word, was he good-looking. Slim, but still muscular, which has always been my type. And he had these thick eyelashes, and so much confidence, and a really big smile. And when I saw him in the lobby, I remember thinking, why can't I meet a guy like that?
I walked right up to her, in that bar, holding, you know, an amp in one hand and a guitar in the other. I said, Miss, I'd like your number, please. She was standing up at the register. She had one hand on her hip. She laughed at me and kind of looked at me sideways. I don't remember exactly what she said, but it was something like, what if you're not my type? I leaned over the bar and said, my name is Billy Dunn. I'm the lead singer of the Dunn Brothers, and if you give me your number, I'll write a song about you. And that got her. That doesn't get every woman, but usually gets the good ones.
I went home and told my mom I met somebody, and she said, nice boy? And I said, well, I don't know about that. Nice never did much for me.
Over the summer and fall of 1969, the Dunn brothers started to book more shows in Pittsburgh and the surrounding towns.
Graham. When Camila started coming out with us, I'll admit I didn't think she'd last much longer than the others. But I should have known she was different. I mean, first time I met her, she came to a gig of ours wearing a Tommy James shirt. She knew good music.
Warren. The rest of us were really starting to get laid, man. And Billy was taking himself off the market. We'd all be with chicks and he'd be sitting there, smoking a joint, having a beer to keep himself busy. I came out of a girl's room one time, zipping my pants up, and Billy was sitting on the sofa watching Dick Cavett. I said, man, you gotta ditch that girlfriend. I mean, we all liked Camila. She was foxy, and she'd tell you your business right to your face, which I liked, but come on.
Billy. I'd been infatuated before and called it love. But when I met Camila, it was something different altogether. She just made the world make sense to me. She even made me like myself more. She'd come watch us practice and listen to my new stuff and give me really good notes on it all, and there was a calmness to her that nobody else had. It felt like when I was with her, I knew everything would be fine. It was like I was following the North Star. You know, Camila was born content, I think. She wasn't born with whatever chip on her shoulder some of us are born with. I used to say I was born broken. she was born whole. That's where the lyrics to Born Broken came from.
Camila. When Billy met my parents for the first time, I was a little nervous. You only get one chance to make a first impression, especially with them. I picked out his outfit down to his socks, made him wear the only tie he had. They loved him, said he was charming. But my mom was also worried about me putting my trust in some guy in a band.
Pete was the only one who seemed to understand why I'd have a girlfriend. Chuck, one time as we were packing up for a show, said, "Just tell her you aren't a one-woman guy. Girls get that." That was not going to work with Camila.
Chuck was real cool. He would cut right to the heart of something. He sort of looked like he'd never had an interesting thought in his life, but he could surprise you. He turned me on to Status Quo. I still listen to them.
On December 1st, 1969, the U.S. Selective Service System conducted a lottery to determine the draft order for 1970. Billy and Graham Dunn, both born in December, had unusually high numbers. Warren just missed the cutoff. Pete Loving fell in the middle. But Chuck Williams, born April 22, 1949, was assigned lottery number 2.
Graham. Chuck got called for the draft. I remember sitting at Chuck's kitchen table, him saying he was going to Vietnam. Billy and I kept thinking of ways he could get out of it. He said he wasn't a coward. Last time I saw him, we played a bar by Duquesne. I said, "You'll just come on back to the band when you're done."
Warren. Billy played Chuck's parts for a while, but we'd heard Eddie Loving, Pete's younger brother, had gotten pretty good at the guitar. We invited him to come audition.
Billy. Nobody could beat Chuck. But then we kept getting more shows, and I didn't want to keep playing rhythm guitar on stage. So we invited Eddie. Figured he could pitch in for a little while.
Eddie Loving. Rhythm guitar, the six. I got along well with everybody. But I could tell Billy and Graham just wanted me to fit into the mold they had set for me, you know? Play this, do that.
A few months in, we heard from one of Chuck's old neighbors.
Chuck died in Cambodia. He wasn't even there 6 months, I don't think. You do sometimes sit and wonder why it wasn't you. What makes you so special that you get to be safe? The world doesn't make much sense.
At the end of 1970, the Dunn brothers played a show at the Pint in Baltimore, where Rick Marks, lead singer for the Winters, was in attendance. Impressed with their raw sound and taking a liking to Billy, he offered them an opening spot on a few shows on their Northeastern tour. The Dunn brothers joined the Winters and quickly became influenced by the Winters' sound and intrigued with their keyboardist, Karen Karen.
Karen Karen, keyboardist, the six. The first time I met the Dunn brothers, Graham asked me, "What's your name?" I said, "Karen," and he said, "What's your last name?" But I thought he said, "What's your name again?" like he didn't hear me, so I said, "Karen." And he laughed and said, "Karen Karen?" Everybody called me Karen Karen from then on. My last name is Circo, for the record, but Karen Karen just stuck.
Billy. Karen added this extra layer, a lushness, to what the Winters were doing. I started thinking maybe we needed something like that.
Graham. Billy and I were starting to think maybe we don't need somebody like Karen. Maybe we need Karen.
I left the Winters because I was sick of everyone in the band trying to sleep with me. I wanted to just be a musician. And I liked Camila. She'd hang out after shows sometimes when she came up to visit Billy. I dug that Billy had her around sometimes or was always on the phone with her. It was a better vibe all around.
Camila. When they went on tour with the Winters, I'd drive up to any weekend shows they had and hang out backstage. I'd have spent 4 hours in the car and I'd get to the venue. Usually these places were pretty sketchy, with gum all over everything and your shoes sticking to the floor. I'd give my name at the door and they'd show me through to the back, and there I was, a part of it all. I'd walk in and Graham and Eddie and everybody would yell, "Camila!" And Billy would walk over and put his arm around me. Once Karen started hanging out too, it just cinched it for me. I felt like this is where I belong.
Graham. Karen was a great addition to the band, made everything better, and she was beautiful too. I mean, in addition to being talented. I always thought she looked a little like Allie McGraw.
Karen, when I said that I dug the fact that the boys and the Dunn brothers weren't trying to get with me, that doesn't go for Graham Dunn. But I knew he liked me for my talent just as much as my looks, so it didn't faze me much. It was sweet, actually. Plus, Graham was a sexy guy, especially in the 70s. I never got the whole Billy is a sex symbol idea. I mean, he had the dark hair, dark eyes, high cheekbones thing. But I like my men a little less pretty. I like it when they look a little dangerous, but are actually very gentle. That's Graham. Broad shoulders, hairy chest, dusty brown hair. He was handsome, but he was still a little rough around the edges. I will admit that Billy knew how to wear a pair of jeans, though.
Billy. Karen was just a great musician. That was all there was to it. I always say I don't care if you're a man, woman, white, black, gay, straight, or anything in between. If you play well, you play well. Music is a great equalizer that way.
Karen, men often think they deserve a sticker for treating women like people.
Warren, that was around the time Billy's drinking seemed like it was getting a little over the edge. He'd party like the rest of us, but when we all went off with the chicks we met, he'd stay up drinking. But he always seemed fine in the morning, and we were all kind of going crazy out there. Except for maybe Pete. He'd met this girl, Jenny, in Boston, and was always on the phone with her.
Graham. Anything Billy does, he goes hard. He loves hard, he drinks hard. Even the way he spends money, like it's burning a hole in his pocket. It was part of the reason why, with Camila, I was telling him to take it slow.
Camila came out with us sometimes, but a lot of the time she waited at home. She was still living with her parents, and I would call her every night from the road.
Camila. When he didn't have a dime to make a call, he'd call collect, and when I answered, he'd say, "Billy Dunn loves Camila Martinez," and then hang up before the charge kicked in. My mom always rolled her eyes, but I thought it was sweet.
Karen. A few weeks after I joined the band, I said, "We need a new name. The Dunn brothers didn't make sense anymore."
Eddie. I'd been saying we needed a new name.
Billy. We had a following with that name. I didn't want to change it.
Warren. We couldn't decide what to call ourselves. I think somebody suggested the Dipsticks. I wanted us to go by Shaggin'.
Eddie, Pete said, "You're never going to get six people to agree on this." And I said, "What about the six?"
Karen, I got a call from a booker in Philly, where I'm from, and he said that the Winters had pulled out of a festival there, asked if we wanted to play. I said, "Right on, but we aren't called the Dunn Brothers anymore." He said, "Well, what do I put on the flyer?" I said, "Not sure yet, but I'll get the six of us there." And I liked how it sounded, the six.
Warren. Part of the brilliance of the name was how close it was to the sex. But I don't think any of us ever talked about that. It was so obvious there was no need to put a finer point on it.
Karen. I was not thinking about it sounding like anything.
Billy. The sex? No, that wasn't a part of it.
Graham. No, it sounded like sex. That was a big part of it.
Billy. We played that show in Philly as the six. And then we got an offer to do another show in town. Another in Harrisburg, another in Allentown. We got asked to play New Year's Eve at this bar in Hartford. We weren't making much money, but I'd spend my last dollar taking Camila out whenever I was home. We'd go to this pizza joint, few blocks from her parents' place, or I'd borrow money from Graham or Warren to take her out somewhere nice. She always told me to cut it out. She'd say, if I wanted to be with a rich guy, I wouldn't have given my number to the singer of a wedding band.
Camila. Billy had charisma, and I fell for all that. I always did. The smoldering, the brooding. A lot of my girlfriends were looking for guys that could afford a nice ring. But I wanted somebody fascinating.
Graham. Around 71, we booked a few shows in New York.
Eddie. New York was... it was how you knew you were somebody.
One night, we're playing a bar over in the Bowery, and out on the street smoking a cigarette is a guy named Rod Reyes.
Rod Reyes, manager of the Six. Billy Dunn was a rock star. You could just see it. He was very cocksure, knew who to play to in the crowd. There was an emotion that he brought to his stuff. It's just a quality that some people have. If you took nine guys plus Mick Jagger and you put them in a lineup, someone who'd never heard of the Rolling Stones before could still point to Jagger and say, that's the rock star. Billy had that, and the band had a good sound.
Billy, when Rod came up to us after that show at the Wreckage, that was the watershed moment.
When I started working with the band, I had some ideas, some of which were well received, and others, not so much.
Graham. Rod told me I needed to cut out half of my solos. Said they were interesting for people that loved technical guitar work, but boring for everyone else.
Rod told me to stop writing about stuff I didn't know about. He said, don't reinvent the wheel, write about your girl. Hands down, best career advice I ever got.
Karen. Rod told me to wear low-cut shirts, and I said, dream on. And that was about the end of that.
Eddie, Rod started getting us gigs all over the East Coast, Florida to Canada.
Warren, let me tell you the sweet spot for being in rock and roll. People think it's when you're at the top, but no, that's when you've got the pressure and the expectations. What's good is when everybody thinks you're headed somewhere fast, when you're all potential. Potential is pure fucking joy.
Graham, the longer we were out on the road, the wilder we all got. And Billy wasn't exactly... look, Billy liked attention, especially from women. But at least at that point, that's all it was. Just attention.
Billy, it was a lot to balance. Loving somebody back home, being out on the road. Girls were coming backstage, and I was the one they wanted to meet. I didn't know what a relationship was supposed to look like.
Camila. We'd started to get into fights, Billy and I. I will admit I wanted something impractical back then. I wanted to date a rock star, but I wanted him available at all times. I'd get mad when he couldn't do exactly what I wanted. I was young. So was he. Sometimes it would get so bad that we'd stop talking for a few days. And then one of us would call the other and apologize, and things would go back the way they were. I loved him, and I knew he loved me. It wasn't easy. But, as my mother used to remind me, you've never been interested in easy.
Graham, this one night, Billy and I were back home getting in the van to head out to Tennessee or Kentucky or somewhere. Camila came to see us off. And when Rod pulled up in the van, Billy was saying goodbye. He moved the hair out of Camila's face and put his lips on her forehead. I remember that he didn't even really kiss her. He just held his lips there. And I thought, I've never cared about anyone like that.
Billy, I wrote Senora for Camila, and let me tell you, people like that song a lot. Pretty soon at our best shows, people were getting up out of their seats, starting to dance, singing along.
I didn't have the heart to tell him that I was technically a señorita. I mean, choose your battles. Besides, once I listen to it, let me carry you on my back. The road looks long and the night looks black, but the two of us are bold explorers, me and my gold señora. I loved it. I loved that song.
We cut a demo of Señora and When the Sun Shines on You.
Rod, my real contacts were all out in L.A. by then. I said to the band, I think it was maybe 72, I said, we gotta go out west.
Eddie, California was where the cool shit was happening. You know what I mean?
Billy, I just thought, there's something inside me that needs to do this.
Warren, I was ready to go. I said, let's get in the van.
I went to Camila's parents' house. I sat her down on the edge of the bed. I said, do you want to come with us? She said, what would I do? I said, I don't know. She said, you want me to just follow you around? I said, I guess. She took a moment and then she said, no, thank you. I asked her if we could stay together and she said, are you coming back? And I told her I didn't know. And she said, then no. And she dumped me.
I got mad that he was leaving, and I blew up at him. I didn't know how else to handle it.
Karen, Camila called me before we left on tour, told me she'd broken up with Billy. I said, I thought you loved him, and she said, he didn't even try to fight me on it. I said to her, if you love him, you should tell him. And she said, he's the one leaving, it's on him to fix this.
Love and pride don't mix.
What could I do? She didn't want to come with me, and I couldn't stay.
We packed up and said goodbye to Mom. She'd married the mailman by then. I mean, I know his name was Dave, but until the day he died, I called him the mailman because that's what he was. He delivered the mail at her office. He was the mailman. Anyway, we left Mom with the mailman and got in the van.
We gigged everywhere along the way from Pennsylvania to California.
Camila made her choice, and there was a big part of me that felt like, all right, I'll be single then, see if she likes that.
Billy straight up lost his mind on that trip.
Rod. It wasn't the women I was worried about with Billy, although there were a lot of women. But Billy would get so messed up after the shows that I'd have to wake him up the next afternoon by slapping him across the face. He was that far gone.
Camila, I was sick to my stomach without him. I was kicking myself every day, waking up in tears. My mom kept telling me to track him down, to take it back. But it felt like it was too late. He'd gone on without me, to make his dreams come true, as he should have.
Warren, when we got to L.A., Rod hooked us up with a few rooms at the Hyatt House.
Greg McGinnis, former concierge, the Continental Hyatt House. Oh, man, I'd love to tell you that I remember the six coming in and staying with us, but I don't. There was so much going on, so many bands back then, it was hard to keep track. I remember meeting Billy Dunn and Warren Rhodes later, but back then, no.
Warren. Rod called in his favors. We started playing bigger gigs.
Eddie, L.A. was a trip. Everywhere you looked, you were surrounded by people who loved playing music, who liked to party. I thought, why the hell didn't we come here sooner? The girls were gorgeous. The drugs were cheap.
Billy. We played a few shows around Hollywood, at the Whiskey, the Roxy, PJs. I had just written a new song called Farther From You. It was all about how much I missed Camila, how far I felt from her. When we hit the strip, that felt like we were really coming into our own.
Graham. All of us started to dress a bit better. You really had to step up your game in L.A. I started wearing my shirts unbuttoned halfway down my chest. I thought I was sexy as hell.
That was about when I got really into, what is it the people call it now, Canadian tuxedo. I was wearing a denim shirt with my jeans pretty much every day.
Karen, I felt like I couldn't focus on playing if I dressed in miniskirts and boots and all that. I mean, I like that look, but I wore high-waisted jeans and turtlenecks most of the time.
Graham, Karen was so fucking sexy in those turtlenecks.
Rod, once they were starting to get some good attention, I set up a show for them at the Troubadour.
Farther From You was a great song, and you could tell Billy felt it. Billy couldn't fake anything. When he was in pain or when he was joyful, you could feel it. That show at the Troubadour that night, as we were playing, I looked over at Karen, and she was in it, you know, and then I looked at Billy, and he's singing his heart out, and I thought, this is our best show yet.
I saw Teddy Price standing in the back listening. I hadn't met him before, but I knew he was a producer with Runner Records. We had a few friends in common. After the show, he came up and found me, said, my assistant heard you guys at PJ's. I told them I would come listen.
Billy. We get off stage and Rod comes up to me with this real tall, fat guy in a suit, and he says, Billy, I want you to meet Teddy Price. First thing Teddy says is, and you have to remember, he had this real thick, upper-crust British accent. You've got a hell of a talent for writing about that girl.
Karen, watching Billy, it felt a little bit like watching a dog find a master. He wanted to please him, wanted the record deal. You could feel it dripping off him.
Warren, Teddy Price was ugly as sin. A face only a mother could love. I'm just messing around. He was ugly, though. I liked that he didn't seem to care.
That's the glory of being a man. An ugly face isn't the end of you.
I shook Teddy's hand, and he asked me if I had any more songs like the ones he'd heard. I said, yes, sir. He said, where do you see this band in 5 years, 10 years? And I said, we'll be the biggest band in the world.
Warren, I signed my first pair of tits that night. This girl comes up to me and unbuttons her shirt and says, sign me. So I signed her. Let me tell you, that's a memory you have for a lifetime.
The following week, Teddy visited the band at a rehearsal space in the San Fernando Valley and listened to the 7 songs they had prepared. Shortly after, they were invited to the Runner Records offices, introduced to CEO Rich Palantino, and offered a recording and publishing deal. Teddy Price, personally, would be producing their album.
Graham, we signed the deal around 4 p.m, and I remember walking out onto Sunset Boulevard, the 6 of us. The sun hitting us right in the eyes and just feeling like Los Angeles had opened its arms and said, come on in, baby. I saw a t-shirt a few years ago that said, I got my shades on because my future's so bright. And I thought, the little shit that was wearing it doesn't know what he's talking about. He never stood on Sunset Boulevard, sun blinding his eyes with his 5 best friends and a record contract in his back pocket.
Billy. That night, everybody was out partying over at the Rainbow, and I walked away. I walked down the street to a payphone. Imagine achieving your wildest dreams and feeling empty inside. It didn't mean anything unless I could share it with Camila. So I called her. My heart was beating so fast as the phone rang. I put my fingers to my pulse, and it was throbbing. But when Camila answered, it was like laying down in bed after a long day. I felt so much better, just hearing her voice. I said, I miss you. I don't think I can live without you. She said, I miss you too. I said, what are we doing this for? We're supposed to be together. She said, yeah, I know. We were both quiet on the line, and I said, if I had a record contract, would you marry me? She said, what?
Camila.
I was just so excited for him if it was true. He'd worked so hard for it.
I said it again. If I had a record contract, would you marry me? She said, you got a record contract? That's when I knew, right then, that Camila was my soulmate. She cared more about the record contract than anything else. I said, you didn't answer my question. She said, did you get a record contract, yes or no? I said, will you marry me, yes or no? She didn't say anything for a while, and then she said, yes.